Good evening, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out this evening for the big Q. All right, so we want to get right into it. Thanks again for staying out with us on your Wednesday evening. Thanks again for being with us. So let's jump right into it. All right, this is your NPR station, 90.3 WBHM Birmingham. I'm Janae Pierre. Earlier this year, a video showed a group of white Alabama high school students drinking and using racial slurs at a gathering off campus. We'll call that gathering a house party. That video went viral and brought a lot of attention to race among young people, specifically how teens talk about race and how those conversations shape their perspectives on race and society. Those are the big questions, and this is the Big Q, WBHM's new live event series that tackles the big questions here in the heart of Alabama. We're here at Iron City with our first panel, and look at their faces. They're eager to start this conversation on youth and race. Please welcome two seniors from Hoover High School, Aaron Williams and Ronald Wan. We also have from Tarrant High School, Gabe Mendez-Francis. Gabe. And last but certainly not least, a senior from the Alabama School of Fine Arts, Clancy Cinco. Audience members, again, we'd love to hear from you, so prepare to pose your questions as well. Let's get right into it. It was confirmed that the teens in the racist viral video were students at Spain Park in Hoover High School. Aaron, I want to talk with you first. As a black student, what was your response to the video? And were you surprised? Was this something that you'd hear?
Honestly, like, I know all the kids in the video. Well, I know three of them. And I was just super surprised to know that they're in my classroom, to know that I talk to them on a daily basis and have these thoughts about my race. Like, I would have never thought that people surrounding me, people in the same environment as me, people who have conversations with me and seem to like me would have these thoughts that are very, very negative and think that, you know, entire race should die off, or, you know, black people are just good for sports and music, and white people give money to black people. So I never would have thought that, you know, people in my environment, in my classroom, sitting next to me, had these thoughts about me per se, because I am black as well.
What about you, Ronald? You attend Hoover High School as well.
Yeah, as an Asian American student, I definitely have like seen other races interact with each other. Maybe not so much towards me, but, you know, between African Americans and Caucasian students, it's definitely been a part of there's been an underlying tone, but definitely nothing so explicit like that has ever come out. I also knew three of the students in the video. And for me, it was pretty shocking at the time, but kind of digging a little bit deeper, a lot of the underlying things I feel like have come up in a couple of different ways throughout the years, but that specific incident really was kind of shaking for our community, especially at the time.
Now, Gabe and Clancy, you two don't attend Hoover schools, but are these things that you'd hear on your school grounds?
Right, so for reference, I am Hispanic, and also Tarrant is a predominantly black school. I've heard from many of my friends personally, there's kind of this perception that, oh, these schools are kind of, you know, they've got their own thing going on. And when this came out, they kind of confirmed this, like, oh man, look at these people over here saying these things. They didn't take it well. And understandably, I mean, I'm not even part of what they were talking about, but I was like, wow, it's you know, it's 2019 now. We shouldn't be having these kind of discussions going on right now. We got to keep moving forward, but we're stuck in the past.
Now, Clancy, you attend the Alabama School of Fine Arts, but you mentioned to me backstage that you actually still knew a couple of the students in the video.
Yes, so I attended Berry Middle School before I came to ASFA, So I knew of at least two of the girls in the video. So it was interesting to see how their personality and that culture has changed from middle school, as those underlying tones have kind of intensified. And obviously, you know, having those private conversations isn't so private anymore, but it shouldn't be a private conversation and types of things we should be talking about and addressing in 2019. And I just, it's just sad knowing that people still think like that when we've come so far, but then we see videos and rhetoric like this that just take us back, you know, leaps and bounds into the past.
Yeah. Erin, I want to come back to you because you mentioned that the people in your class, you learned that they felt that way. So with that said, can you recall a time when your classmate, when you or your classmate experienced hate speech?
Yes. Me personally, like in ninth grade, I still experience hate speech now, but in ninth grade specifically, I remember a girl coming up to me. I had on a green shirt, and I had my hair natural, like in a puff, and she told me I looked like burnt broccoli. So it's even those small little aspects, those things coming out of people's mouths that they think is okay, but it's really not. It's like, oh, it's just a joke, or, oh, I'm just kidding. But no, you're not kidding. You really mean what you say, and what comes out of your mouth has the possibility to hurt people. So you have to be mindful of those things. Once again, that's just not okay. So that's an experience that I had with hate speech, as well as just, you know, being called the black girl that's always, you know, like doing all the diversity around the school. But why do I have to be that black girl? Why can't I just be a human being that's advocating for what's right?
Yeah. And when you said, yeah. What other kinds of hate speech would you experience now?
Now?
Yeah.
Now I would experience hate speech about being called, like, the N-word. You know, a lot of people don't think that white people say the N-word, like, straight to black people, but that occurs.
So, Ronald, I want to come to you because you mentioned to me that you have a diverse friend group only because of the population of Chinese and Asian Americans at Hoover High School, but you have a diverse friend group. How does your friend group talk about race, if it comes up at all?
Yeah, so there's not a lot of Chinese American students at Hoover High School, but we do have a pretty diverse student population just generally. So, you know, I have a lot of chances to interact with various different friend groups. Just generally at like a school so the size of Hoover, I feel like there's a lot of stratification going on. Like, a lot of the friend groups kind of look inwards to one another instead of looking outwards. So basically, like, you know, each one of our friend groups would kind of like exclude the others. So once you like walk into a cafeteria, you can see like where the like sort of Asian Americans, maybe like Indians, they sit together, and then, you know, the African American students are all on one table on one side of the lunchroom, and then the Caucasian students on one another part of the lunchroom. And a lot of us don't even eat together, even in the lunchroom. A lot of us kind of, you know, go back to our classrooms to eat or do other sorts of things during lunchtime. And so just seeing that aspect of our school systems kind of self-segregating in a sense to branch out and kind of really like the diversity that you see on paper doesn't show in the classroom or in our community in that sense, mm-hmm. which sometimes to me is a little bit concerning, especially when we're talking about race.
Yeah, I can only imagine that. In fact, Hoover is one of the most diverse cities in this area, and I think the schools now, they show that, it shows. Clancy, I want to get to you because you mentioned that you have a diverse friend group as well. When things like this video, when stuff like that happens, what does that conversation sound like amongst you and your friends?
So among my friend group, we talked about the video, and a lot of my friends, African-American friends, they didn't directly address it, because bringing up instances where they've experienced racism can be painful for them and traumatizing and not exactly a comfortable situation to be in. But within our school, since we weren't directly affected by the video, our administration didn't take action to look within ourselves. Our administration and most of our teachers are Caucasian, and so we see that within our own school in the decisions that are handed down to the student population. And a lot of times they don't think about the cultural differences in things within students. So seeing the video and looking at my friend group made me become more thankful for the people that I was surrounded by, because if I was in a mostly white friend group, then the conversation would be very different. So.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to your, I want to talk about your school situation though, even though, you know, things that happened in the video weren't necessarily happening at ASFA. You guys are dealing with something different. You mentioned the lack of teachers of color, and you're in the dance department. I guess like situations like hair mm-hmm. may come up, right? Let's talk about something like that.
Yes, so within the dance department, we do ballet and modern, and so within ballet, that's a very European art form. And so the standard is, you know, we wear white or pink tights, and we have to have our hair very slick back. And there was a student that, African-American student, that she had dreads. And our teachers didn't understand why she couldn't get her hair to be perfectly slicked back, just like the white, you know, her white students around her. And so it turned into a whole argument and issue within the department, because at that point, our department was over half minority. So it was a conversation that needed to happen, and the student was almost kicked out of the school because of it. And then we also, the pink tights, within the dance community, there is a trend and more normality that African-American students or Hispanic students can wear like flesh-toned tights. And under our previous director, we were not allowed to do that. And with our new director, he allowed that. And our teachers had a very interesting reaction. They thought it wasn't proper, and they saw it as something that was going against ballet tradition. And we see that in little ways every single day, especially studying ballet because of the body standards and the image.
Audience members, a reminder, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question, just fill out a little sheet, and our volunteers are waiting for you. In fact, we're going to get to a couple questions. All right, we have Al Elliott. Al Elliott.
Hi. I just think, just from my personal experience and having conversations with people, most people don't know what race is. And I'll just be curious for just the conversation and the sake of the room, what everybody thinks it is, and then kind of figure it out. Kind of to undo racism, because I think it works similarly to capitalism. Like, the only purpose of capital is capitalism. So the only purpose of race is a function of racism. But to understand what racism is, first, I think, will help us undo the entanglement of the systems that she talked about undoing. So just for the sake of the conversation, I'm curious to know how the students or just anybody would define it.
Okay. Tackling the isms, your definition on race?
I mean, I don't know the official definition, but within just talking to other students, and my opinion is just different colors of people and different cultures that are behind that particular skin color. I don't know if that's exactly politically correct, but that's what I've come to gather. I've never put thought to what is race. So if anyone else has.
Well, I do think the biggest piece of that is the ism, as Al mentioned. Go ahead, Gabe.
I'm gonna be honest, man. I don't know. I mean, so I first kind of saw it when I was in like elementary or middle school, and then we did these tests, and they were like, oh, what race are you? Are you white? Are you black? Are you Hispanic? Are you Latino? Are you Asian? I'm like, wait a minute. One of these is a skin color. Another one of these is general cultural background. That's two completely different things. So I kind of just backtracked and said, you know what, man? We're all human. We all look a little different. We come from different backgrounds. I don't know if that's evasive or not, but I just see everybody as human. I know that's kind of a yeah answer, but yeah.
So I kind of define racism as oppressing a group of people based off of their skin color. That's just my, you know, very surface level definition of race. Because what else more could it be? Yes, there's all these systemic problems, and there's, you know, political problems and financial problems and all of things that contribute to racism. But like the blunt definition is oppressing a group of people because of the color of their skin or where they come from.
All right, so we have another question from Catherine Harrington. Catherine?
Thank you all for being here, especially. I know that sitting up there listening to our questions is not the most favorite thing that you could possibly be doing, so we really appreciate it. When all of this happened, I know that Hoover and Spain Park at various times, the administration kind of said, oh, we're going to have seminars and a day of concern and talks and things. Did you feel like the administrations of Hoover High School and Spain High School was reasonable in response to what you heard in those videos?
Well, I kind of have a personal connection because Ronald and I both are on the Diversity Council at Hoover High School. I can't speak for Spain Park because I really don't know how their high school ran things. But as far as Hoover, our principal came to the Diversity Council personally and was like, hey, we have this problem. It was the day after the video had happened. We have this problem. What can we do? What can I do? What is the correct response to this? And we threw ideas at him, really good ideas in my opinion. You know, some of them came from me, so. but the whole like thing was he didn't want to do something where there would be a negative reaction or somebody would be hurt or something like that. So he was kind of looking for a correct answer. And I think that's kind of what hurt me the most, because like I've said before, there is not a correct answer. You cannot go at this a certain way and just hope for the best. There's so many different things that we could have done. Yes, we had, you know, he addressed it over the intercom, was like, hey, you know, we have this video, everyone knows of it, we're gonna do better, basically. Well, duh, like, we gotta do better. but, you know, and then we had like these sessions in the library where they brought in outside counseling to, you know, have these hard conversations. And I know a lot of the students were mad about that because it was optional. So of course, the people who need to be having the conversations aren't gonna show up. So, you know, what good does that do? We don't know, but it was something. So I think our whole thing was like, just do something, because if you don't do anything, then you're gonna look terrible. And we recently had like a unity walk, and it was basically kids could sign up for free and during sixth period walk around in a circle in unity. And yes, that's a great idea, and it was really amazing, and it was very powerful. Kind of felt like, you know, back to civil rights. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, it was optional. Once again, what good does it do? Are we having these real conversations? We need to have them in the classroom. So to answer your question, I think that the administration did something, but I think they did it to cover their behinds and not necessarily because they really want to, you know, drive for diversity. So they did something. That's all I can say.
I would definitely concur to what Erin was talking about, especially just the different reactions from the administrations. You know, you can definitely see a difference between Hoover's reaction and Spain Park's reaction. Just for example, you know, like Hoover took a couple of days to kind of react to the problem, whereas Spain Park, by Tuesday, they were having, you know, every teacher in the classroom not teach any classes and simply just have discussions if they felt comfortable about the topics at hand. But see, that the problem with that, with Spain Park, was that not every teacher was in the right place to have that specific discussion. And, you know, in the news, you saw that one of the teachers specifically was, you know, called out, and she said something offensive.
She said the N-word
in one of those discussions, meant to kind of provide more unity. And so, like, introducing those discussions introduces another, like, challenge for our administrators to kind of look toward. And that, for me, I think I can kind of feel for our principal, especially at Hoover. But we also do need to find more solutions to have that as a community. I think having that as a community is just something that a lot of us are scared of having. Even with this video coming out, we're still going to be, we still have like a lot of work to do in order to continue and progress this conversation in the future.
Thanks, Ronald. Yeah. All right, each of you in less than 60 seconds, please tell me, what can schools do to improve race relations?
All right. So I think that it all starts in curriculum. The curriculum needs to be changed. There needs to be more diverse like cultures and ethnics and all that into history classes, English teachers. With that being said, it's possible to educate kids because it all starts when they're little. They're not going to grow up to hate people because they've learned in school that it is not okay. So I think it all starts with the curriculum. And if, you know, the state or the federal, or I really don't know how that works, but whoever, if they just get those things put in the curriculum and we learn how to be better humans, then, you know, society will be okay. We just have to learn how to be accepting. Yeah, we have to learn how to be accepting to other people.
Ronald, 60 seconds. Thank you, Aaron.
For me, it's pretty simple. It's just about taking ownership and really engaging. So teachers and administrators definitely should, you know, first off, like, just start talking about these difficult conversations with each other, but also with their students. So it's not about sitting back and kind of allowing another person to, you know, maybe start the conversation. Really, every person should be taking ownership in their communities and starting this conversation up, continuing it, and making sure it gets heard. No matter, like, your race, religion, or how much power you actually have in the community, you know, these conversations provide us such an opportunity, both, like, from individual level, like, to, you know, us as a community. Each one of us can have a profound impact in our school systems and, you know, in the education of our children. So definitely engaging, putting this out there for more and more people to hear, no matter where we stand personally, and just, you know, going out there and doing it, I guess.
Gabe, quickly. Thanks, Ronald.
So if there's one thing I learned this year in high school, it's that there are some topics that the administration will never talk about for fear of either the news media catching up on them or legal litigation. You know, there's that one teacher you had. Maybe it was in middle school or high school. You know, it was that one teacher who was like, "Ah, oh, she's so cool." That teacher, she's the one, or he's the one. They need to be the one to tell you, hey, you know, this is something that we need to talk about shamelessly, because no matter what the administration says, this is something that you'll never be taught if you just follow the regular curriculum. As teachers, it is their responsibility to talk about these issues openly, raw, whatever you want to say. Just say, okay, here's the issue at hand. Here are the facts. What can we do about this? How can we be better as a society, as a person, as a whole?
Thanks, Dave.
So what I think we need to do is, I agree with all my panelists, it starts in the curriculum, but it also starts with our teachers, because we can't expect our teachers to be fully trained. I think we need to have diversity training and talk about the outside of the classroom things, because we can't expect our teachers to all have the same opinion and be the cool teachers that we remember. And I also think it starts with a curriculum, and that in Alabama, the Alabama State Legislature set our curriculum. And so it's going out and voting and voicing your opinion and moving forward and educating people on the way to your end goal, which is equality and creating a space that we can have these conversations and fix our systems.
Okay, that's it. Yes. All right. Well, that wraps up the first half of the Big Q. I'd like to thank our student panelists for joining us this evening. Please, a round of applause for Aaron Williams, Ronald Wong, Dave Mendez Francis, and Clancy Cinco. Yes.
Welcome back. I'm Andrew Yeager. We're here at Iron City in Birmingham for a discussion about race and youth. We've been hearing from students, but what about the adults in the room? Teachers encounter race on a number of fronts. They teach about it formally through history lessons, but there are the informal lessons as well, helping students understand race-related events in the news or helping them understand cross-racial relations. How do educators deal with race in the classroom? Well, we'll dive into that with our next panel. We're joined now by Tondra Loder-Jackson, a professor of educational foundations in the UAB School of Education. Her research and teaching interests include urban education and Birmingham civil rights. Also, Joyce Stallworth, an associate provost emerita at the University of Alabama, also an adjunct professor at the State University of New York, Buffalo State. She also has taught at the high school and community college levels and currently teaches courses in 9 foreign countries. And finally, Berkan Seiger. He's a social studies teacher at Holy Family Cristo Rey Catholic High School in Birmingham. He's a graduate of Spain Park High School and UAB. He's also taught social studies and Bessemer in Fairfield. And for the audience here, we want to hear from you as well. What do you remember from your time as a student? What were you taught or not taught about race? If you're a parent, what do you hope that your children hear at school? I want to start with you, Tondra Loder-Jackson. You're a teacher. You're in the classroom. I want to have these conversations. I don't know how. Where do I start that process in thinking about engaging race in the classroom?
I think something that the young people a moment ago uncovered is that the adults are sometimes just as afraid as the students are. And so I think being honest about the fact that race is a tough topic and acknowledging our fear is very important. I also try to start from a standpoint of humility, to realize that I have my own biases, my own blind spots that I have to examine. I also, when I'm teaching, I have to understand that one course, one seminar, is not going to change a lifetime of socialization about race. But it can be transformative if I do it in the right way. So those perspectives are very important. There is a pedagogy associated with that. There's a way you go about teaching about difficult dialogues, which some universities use that term. And so I try to draw on as much literature, as many resources as I can about how to delve into tough topics. Several years ago, back in 2006, there was a really popular approach to teaching about race called Courageous Conversations. Glenn Singleton, Curtis Linton are two of the people who were involved with that. And when they engage people in conversations about race, there are 4 things that they expect people to agree upon. That they've got to stay engaged in the conversation, that they have to recognize that they're going to experience some discomfort, that they can only speak their own truth, and that they have got to accept and expect that there's going to be some non-closure, that you won't always come to some agreement, some kind of conclusion that's satisfying for everyone. And I think that it's important to understand that.
So you've almost got to have like ground rules, a common understanding about how we collectively are going to approach this.
Absolutely.
Berkan, I'm curious for you, because you're in a situation where you're white, but you're teaching in a majority black school. You've taught in other majority black schools as well. What does the conversation look like in Mr. Seiger's history class?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how you talk about, I teach government and economics as well, and I'm not sure how you talk about those subjects without getting into race. For me, what do you see the purpose of history? What can students learn from social science classes? To me, it's really critical thinking skills and persuasive writing skills. It's not necessary to know certain historical events to keep a job later in life. But what is important is to know how to find evidence, how to analyze and evaluate the evidence, and how to present it in a way that gets your point across effectively. and history is just full of a lot of examples where you you really have to sit down and force yourself to think, what is the most correct version? History is often seen as a set of facts, and that's simply not true. It's a debate. History is written down by us, and we are very biased. So we have to figure out what is the most true version and sit in that uncertainty that we'll probably never find the true version.
So you have that interpretation. Joyce Stallworth, I want to get you in the conversation here. One of the themes that we've had throughout this discussion is fear. And if you're a teacher, you know, this is your professional life, and I'm concerned about not just what my students think, but I have parents, I have administrators, there are all sorts of pressures on me. I'm going to throw this bomb of race in the middle of that. What do you do with that fear? How do you deal with that?
Allow me just a very brief anecdote,
sure.
And I'll get into that. In the Hoover school system, a young white male, in describing a television show, casually used the N-word. A black male student who heard him popped him. We have a situation in this particular school system, not picking on the Hoover school system, but this was one example that a personal friend told me about because it was her son who did the popping. So he got 3 days in school suspension. The white student got some kind of punishment meted out to him too. So it's not something that we can afford to whitewash, that we can afford to be fearful of, because it's here and we have to have these difficult conversations. As the kid said, I think that if we just listen to them, we can have a pathway toward having these necessary conversations in the classroom. As others have said, it's not only in the what we teach, but it's how we teach. So as teachers can find intentional and purposeful ways to have these conversations, not made up, but real ways that we can have students interact with each other in equitable and fair ways, that they're working on a project together. And so it's very hard to fear someone, to hate someone, when you are mutually invested in getting something done. Our grade depends on this, so we need to find a path forward to get the work done, whether it's a garden project, whether it's a STEM project, whether it's a music project, whatever it might be, kind of transcending those fears, because this is the work that has to be done, and this is how we have to get through it. And again, I always kind of backward map to the notion of how might we listen well, ask questions, and help us all on a path of greater self-discovery. As Tondra said, we all have our biases. And so how do we confront those? How do we own those? How are we transparent about those? As we engage our students, engage ourselves, and when a critical mass of teachers can come together and say, these are some difficult situations, and so let's do this in a safe environment where we can get to some path forward so that we can help our students become the leaders in this global world that they have to be.
Tondra Litter Jackson, you're helping train future teachers through your work at UAB. How much does the issue of race come up in those 4 years as they prepare to be in the classroom? Because there are a lot of pressures on teachers.
There are a lot of pressures on teachers. To be honest, I don't think my students would talk about race as much in the classroom if I didn't bring it up, if they didn't have to take my class. A problem in education is how we compartmentalize the topic of race. We have the go-to person who teaches the diversity class. You know, that's the race person, so to speak. And then you have a curriculum where there may be only one course that focuses on that. So that's some of the concern that we face in teacher education, that we really need to address diversity issues across the curriculum, across the board. But I stepped back and took a look at some data on how teachers in general are dealing with issues of race, and specifically dealing with issues of hate and intolerance. And Teaching Tolerance, an organization in Montgomery, Alabama, some of you may be familiar with it, that's dedicated to addressing issues of hate and intolerance. They published a report in 2018 called Hate at School Report. And you had over 2,700 educators who responded in this report. and they reported over 3,000 incidences of school-based hate just in the fall 2018 semester, and that was four times as many reports of hate in the media for the entire year of 2018. And racism was generally the motivation behind the hate and bias incidents in schools. But what these teachers were deeply disturbed about is that very few students were disciplined when they were involved in these situations. It really speaks to their concerns about the administration. They said 9 times out of 10, administrators failed to denounce the bias or reaffirm school values. So that tells us that not only do the teachers need more quality professional development, and it's gotta be ongoing, it's gotta be site-based, meaning at their school, but their administrators need help with that as well. Our student panel mentioned some of the challenges that her principal had with coming up with a response, and I don't judge him. Administrators, they have a highly politicized role. They do have to pay close attention to messaging and so forth. But we've got to find a way in schools of education to help administrators and teachers feel much more comfortable addressing not only race, but hate incidences in schools.
Joy Stallworth, I wonder from your experience, how do you see race being discussed or not discussed as we train future teachers?
It's not only race, it's all issues of difference. It's so potentially divisive, so it's easier to talk about the methods of teaching English at the secondary level than the influence of race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, all of those different ways that we are different. The fear is there. But also, I think that our teacher ed programs do a really good job with, to the extent that they can, given the milieu in which we exist. But I think, as Tundra said, it is responsibility of all of us, not only teacher educators, but schools, our teachers, our principals, our parents and families. I don't want to leave anyone out because the accountability is on all of us. The numbers, we've all seen those numbers that we need more diversity in the teaching profession in our state, across this country. If we don't have that, those conversations can still happen. As a white male teacher, you can have those conversations and you're comfortable with that, and you can help kind of demystify all of this and deconstruct these very difficult topics in ways that perhaps you can do it better because you are a white male talking to white colleagues, for example. I think that you would have done a much better job leading those seminars that Hoover had rather than an outside person come in, an outside expert, because so often schools call in outside experts to come and solve problems. That's not the way that a problem is solved. It has to be resolved from within. And so how do we give teachers that time, space, and cover, if you will, to have those difficult conversations that they need to have? So it's not one day workshop on diversity that's going to solve a problem. It's a commitment to sustain conversations.
Berkan, with this idea of training teachers, you went to UAB. How do you feel you were prepared in this realm?
I was reflecting back on my UAB education to try and remember something that may have stuck out to me about talking about difficult issues in the classroom, but unfortunately I couldn't remember anything about that. Honestly, my first year in the classroom, I felt very underprepared. The way that teachers can learn how to talk about difficult issues in the classroom is, unfortunately, through classroom experience. And that's the best way to do it. But there's an issue with that. NPR has an article that shows that the National Center of Educational Statistics found 17% of teachers leave the profession within the first 5 years. Unfortunately, I think that they're not in the classroom long enough to develop the skills that are necessary, and they end up leaving altogether before they can even confront those issues in the classroom.
You're listening to The Big Q, Race and Youth. I'm Andrew Yeager. We're talking with Tundra Loader-Jackson, an education professor at UAB, also Joyce Stallworth, former associate provost at the University of Alabama, and Berkan Seiger, social studies teacher at Holy Family Cristo Rey High School in Birmingham. I'm going to go to the audience here. Erica McNeil of Birmingham.
Hi. As he said, my name is Erica McNeil, and I work for the Office of Peace and Policy for the City of Birmingham. And it's kind of a two-part question. And the first part is, do you think that the discomfort and the disregard for addressing racism or things like that is because the lack of the true narratives of the actual United States. If we address the actual narratives of what happened
the true narratives.
Do you think that that would help in making it a more comfortable conversation to have? And secondly, it goes into what you made a statement about race being a central part in the social sciences and teaching that. So if race really is a central part of that, how is it that we've gone so far without actually teaching those true narratives of the United States? How can you get forward without addressing the true narratives, without romanticizing them, without it being highly exclusionary? How can we move forward?
One thing you do is you stop using textbooks. Textbooks are extremely Eurocentric. I'm a history teacher. I loved history all throughout school. But it wasn't really until I took some college classes that I realized that the history that I learned in high school wasn't really the complete story.
I want to add to that, and you teach in a private school, correct? When you were in the public school, did you feel like you had as much freedom to select other textbooks for history?
I never used the textbook.
Okay, that's good to know also. All right. I will say one way that I try to disrupt the narratives, if you will, is through summer teacher institutes, where we teach teachers across the nation about the civil rights movement. And we use a lot of text, if you will, that are beyond the textbook. Films, we take them to museums, they look at primary source documents, so we take them to archives. So the National Endowment for the Humanities sponsors a number of summer teacher institutes that, in my view, I think help to disrupt some of those narratives. So the information is out there, but we do still have to work on teacher training. And frankly, during the No Child Left Behind days and a lot of these reforms, history got pushed to the back burner. We're kind of moving out of that, but we still don't have as much emphasis on history, I think, as we should, let alone a diversity of texts that we draw on.
I'm going to go back to the audience. Tony Mueller?
You know, there's this idea that racism starts at home. Are there ways that educators can educate or empower students to kind of bring these difficult conversations back home, or, you know, have these conversations with positions of authority that I could incorporate into my experience with, you know, undergraduates at the university? You know, is there a way we can make school the place where anti-racism starts?
Well, something that I've learned through being a teacher is that it's really difficult for me to teach over children's parents. I can tell the student one version of the story in the classroom, but that's not the version that their parents understand, and that's not the version their parents want them to understand. So it's really difficult to try and, like I said, teach over what they're getting from the home. But I know that when I was younger, I was the one starting uncomfortable Thanksgiving conversations. And I hope that through the way that I teach my kids, that they're the ones starting uncomfortable Thanksgiving conversations. To give them these stories that other people might not necessarily know.
Back to the audience, William. I don't have a last name, so. William has a question, says, what is the most valuable advice you would give to the generation following you to end discrimination and yield talks like this? How can we spur these conversations beyond people that might be inclined to have them anyway?
I've got a quote. From Michael Schwebel. He says, perhaps by looking for and seriously considering alternative views, and there are always multiple alternatives, we will eventually get closer to a better version of the truth. That is something to aim for. In the meantime, it is wise to consider alternative views because doing so can help us see how competing versions of the truth are created. In this way, we can learn more about how others see the world, how we have come to see the world, and what more we might see if we are willing to suffer a bit of uncertainty. So you have to be willing to suffer that uncertainty. You have to be willing to be uncomfortable. But people don't like being uncomfortable. But if we boil down history to feel-good stories, then we make history simple-minded. And I think it's just a willingness to challenge yourself. But that's hard, and people don't like hard things.
I think that we have to confront the isms I think it's difficult, and I think that you have to be comfortable. You have to have the intestinal fortitude to do what you believe is right in our workplaces, at the Thanksgiving table, and confront, I don't mean in an angry or aggressive way, but going back to my point of asking the question and listening for responses, perhaps helping each other, work through, well, why is it that I'm just so angry with this blank person? And trying to unpack that. But I think that the dialogue is great, and I think that confront, however it's comfortable for you to do that confrontation, and understanding the limits of that too. But I just think that, again, we're at a point right now in our country that we have to stand for something. If it's a problem that you see, how can you use what you know to kind of transcend and help, again, each other, whether it's a family member, a colleague, whatever it might be, to just think before we get to that point where the child of a good friend of mine resorted to hitting someone because of the hurtful word that was used.
We're running short on time, so I want to quick responses to this final question. We'll go down the panel. What signs would you want to see? What would be a clue to you that says our education system is doing better at handling matters of race in the classroom? What would you like to see that would tell you progress is being made?
Well, I think when, you know, most people, when they think about school diversity, they really only have one thing on their mind, and that's student population. You know, one of the problems with that is you're putting, conversations about race or desegregation on kids, and you're kind of leaving the adults out of the equation. There needs to be better diversity of faculty. Students need to hear from a diverse faculty. They need perspectives from people who came from different walks of life, from different communities, who have different cultures. So I think one of the things that would really show that we're getting better is having a more diverse faculty at all schools. As you see, predominantly black schools have almost have a predominantly black faculty, and same with predominantly white schools.
I would say a few markers. One, definitely reports like the one about hate at school. Certainly want to see a drastic reduction, certainly an elimination of those incidences of hate. That would tell us we have definitely moved in the right direction. But if we have more of our students who are no longer coming home or going on panels and saying, I've never heard about Native American history, I've never heard about this, that would tell me we're moving in the right direction if they are at least getting some of that content. I would also feel like we're moving in the right direction if we had more administrators who supported their teachers when they did go out on a limb and teach that controversial subject matter in a pedagogically sound way, and they support them in doing so. When non-tenured teachers don't feel fearful of doing the right thing, I'd feel like we're moving in the right direction. And when I'd see more students standing up for other students who are different from them, being their allies. So whether it's students who self-identify as being straight, supporting students who are part of the LGBTQ community, more young men standing up for young women, more of those alliances would definitely tell me we're moving in the right direction.
I concur with all of that. And just simply, if we have fewer viral videos of our kids locally in Tuscaloosa and Birmingham and Hoover and Alabama going on racist tirades.
Well, that brings our discussion to a close. I'd like to thank all of our panelists, Tondra Loader Jackson with UAB, Joyce Stallworth, former Associate Provost at the University of Alabama, and also Berkan Seiger, a social studies teacher at Holy Family Cristo Rey High School here in Birmingham. Thanks to you as well, our audience, for your thoughts and comments. We'd also like to thank the staff of Iron City for hosting this program. The Big Q is produced by Gigi Duban and Audrey Atkins. Technical support was provided by Daryl McCullough with additional help from the rest of the WBHM staff. Our general manager is Chuck Holmes. For Janae Pierre and all of us at WBHM, I'm Andrew Yeager. Thanks for listening.